Accession number 16750, Reel 4.
Of what was wrong with the Swift Mark in was tested, which was basically everything you can think of thought was tried in order to agree that not under pressure from them that's the way it did. And so, but the thing was the firm had done a great deal of work on it happened on the Swift. There's no doubt about it. When they got aeroplanes back, they did their best to improve them before they came back to Boscombe. But the Swift, the Mark III, of course, had reheat as well, but it had all the improvement modifications that the Mark I and Mark II had. But happily, it also had the one improvement, really, in the whole of the Swift saga that made a significant difference to high Mark number, high altitude handling, and that was a wing leading edge extensions. Now, I did read somewhere that they'd been tried before in Supermarines, right back in the business, but had been thrown aside. I don't think that's probably true. The great thing about it was the Mark II was in such a state with increased weight and various other attributes that it was becoming extremely difficult to land and was a real handful landing on a 2,000-yard runway in wet weather. The leading edge extensions made a considerable difference to the pitch up, which was the main trouble in longitudinal handling. But the great thing it did was it virtually transformed the landing characteristics, and the Swift Mark III was a much easier aircraft to land than the Mark II was, which was a great thing. And then, of course, ultimately speaking, we got onto the Mark IV, and the modifications that were done, the Mark IV came in a highly modified state with all the Mark III mods, slight difference to the profile of the leading edge extensions, but everything else was roughly similar. And of course, it not only had reheat, but it had a variable incidence tail. But the great difficulty there was that we'd all thought it'll all be easier when you have a VI tail, and hadn't quite realised, I think, to be just, that the VI tail was definitely going to make things more controllable. But if, because your stick forces were too heavy and I'll start again on that one. Will you just hang on a sec while I...
The user edits it.
Right.
Okay.
Well, the difficult thing about VI tails was, despite the fact that they were thought going to be an extremely useful thing, and in many respects they were, over one of the great difficulties with the Swift, which was the high altitude manoeuvrability, we hadn't properly realised that if you get to the stage where you can't turn because the stick force is too heavy, or you've got the stick fully back and you need to turn tighter, then of course you'd use the VI tail to trim to make life easier for you. That, in actual fact, worked very well. It almost instantly made it much more satisfactory for manoeuvre. But if that meant at the time you were doing that, the Mach number dropped from the number that you were at, which if you were increasing the turn, of course it automatically would do, then you would get to a stage where, in actual fact, with a higher tail setting than you would normally have, a more lift-producing tail setting than you would normally have, you get to the lower Mach number where the elevator would become ineffective, and it would itself generate a kind of a pitch-up, which was an automatic accrement of G that you didn't really want. And this proved so difficult, in fact, that if you got to the stage where you were diving and or pulling out, and in the pull-out you used the tail, and as the Mach number dropped off in the pull-out, then the elevator became effective again, you would get a very, very notable and even dangerous increase in G, and on several occasions I exceeded the structural limits of the aeroplane, which is 7.33 G, in these exercises quite unwittingly, And of course, we were bothered about that, as you could imagine. So there was the Mark III. It was not really very much better than any of the other Marks. It certainly wasn't satisfactory for full operational use. The main trouble was still the amount of lift available from the wing. And so we wrote to the Ministry of Supply and said, this is what it's like. It won't work properly as a fighter, and we don't think it should have a release, but if we do, this will be the limits. And if the Air Force want it, they can have it on this basis. Well, the Air Force didn't want it, and it never went into service. And the only service flying it ever did after it left us was to go to CFE for a tactical evaluation, which is the first time they'd really seen anything like a proper Swift. And I flew it down there myself after we'd finished, the day we'd finished the Mark III trials, in fact, which led us on to the Mark IV, which should have been very much better. I've got myself tangled up in Marks.
Mark IV you're on now.
Yes, I am. But the great thing about it is that the Mark III, of course, didn't have a VI tail. It only had the reheat. Mm-hmm. What I've said before, connected with the VI tail, was a Mark IV criticism, mm-hmm, rather than a Mark III criticism. Right. That will have to be fiddled, mm-hmm, inside the thing. There was so much work to be done on the Swift, so comprehensive were the trials. I got myself tied up there, and that was wrong. Those comments about the VI tail are perfectly acceptable, accurate comments, but they're not applicable to the Mark III that didn't have it. The Mark III never went into service because we couldn't give a release that the service wanted. When the Mark IV came along, we just said, this is what it's like. The VI tail won't work. In actual fact, it does have dangerous characteristics. The rest of the aeroplane is very much heavier. It isn't giving you the kind of performance it likes, what you want. It had to go back to the firm, incidentally, after its first arrival, and the firm did a lot more work on it again in elevator control surfaces. And when we got it back, one could say that pitch up was more or less confined and controllable, and various other aspects of the aircraft, notably lateral control, were better. But in actual fact, with the VI difficulty I've mentioned earlier, it still wouldn't make a fighter. We assessed the fact that it was only usable up to 38,000 to 40,000 feet at best, which was not really good enough for an OR which asked for 45 and a ceiling of 50. And that in actual fact its longitudinal control was really so uncrisp that it was going to be outclassed by all other fighters that we knew about on both sides above 15,000 feet. And of course the Air Force didn't accept it, and almost immediately after we'd put that clearance in, offered clearance in 1955, February 55, production stopped and the whole program was cancelled in April of that year. The final thing on Swifts of the fighter variant, because this virtually finished it, of course, was that they had done development on a full flying tail, often called a slab tail, before this time, and they wanted us to have a look at it from Boscombe. I went and I flew it three times in July and August of that year. And it was a fascinating, although weird, experience. It was worked extremely well, other than at high Mach numbers, as you would expect it to do. But at high Mach numbers, of course, you weren't getting any more lift from the wing. So you've got this great, powerful beast at the back. It would get you up to pitch up level in no time flat. Then you had to push the stick forward again. Then and the pitch up would decline. Then you could use the tail again, pull back on the stick, and you get to pitch up level. And in the end, of course, what you did is you flew around a polygon instead of flying around a curve. It was interesting, but operationally useless. There is absolutely no... It wasn't the Philosopher's Stone, as everybody thought it would be. There is no substitute for lift. And that's it. That was all the Swift except for the Mark V. And the Mark V was a delightful aeroplane, purely and simply because it was a low-level aeroplane. Flown at high level, it would operate in exactly the same way as we previously discussed, but at low level, it had excellent characteristics. The Swift had always been good at high indicated airspeed, and the 5 was a high indicated airspeed aeroplane. It had lots of fuel. It had a good cockpit. It had excellent power controls and indications for them. And it was, in fact, a highly successful aeroplane. And other people, I flew it a good deal, and I also flew it a bit in service when I was at Sylt, when it came for gunnery exercises. But there are people much more qualified than I to give details about the Swift 5. Nevertheless, to repeat, it was a pleasure to fly. And actually, while I was in Ministry of Defence, it was then still the Air Ministry, I did actually come back to do some trials for A Squadron on the Mark 5 Swift on the comprehensive handling while I was on leave, which shows you, I think. So that's it, really, on Swifts.
You were mentioning about the fact that Supermarines, a lot of these problems were probably contributed by the workload.
Yes, I think that's definitely so. I think they were really seriously overburdened with research work in their technical office. They had the Swift, they were developing the Scimitar, they had all sorts of naval research to do. In fact, the Swift itself was attractive to the Navy at one particular time. And of course, in addition to that, they had genuine research aircraft like the Seamew, I think it was. And all this took them off. They had excellent test pilots right the way across the board, and quite a few of them. But I think they had almost too much work in that area, and definitely too much work in the technical office area. And I think the final thing was that Joe Smith, who was very, very cut up about the failure of the Swift, had burned himself out, really, on all the developments on the Spitfire throughout the war, which he'd done, and just definitely wasn't quite the man he was as chief designer at that particular time.
Can you talk a little bit now about the Hunter, because that was coming through at about the same time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Very slightly behind, but only very slightly. And oddly enough, the Hunter had very similar difficulties earlier on to the Swift. It had one great extra difficulty, and that is Sidney Cam, who was a very obdurate, distinguished old gentleman, refused to pay attention to air brakes. As we used to say rather snidely, his view was, didn't have air brakes on me Hurricane, not going to have them on me Hunter. And that's the way it went. And that's definitely so, because he kicked up a great fuss when the Hunter first came in, the Hunter 1, because, quite frankly, the only way you could get it into the circuit was by applying G by turning round the airfield vigorously to get the speed down, and that's the only way you could do it. There was nothing else to slow it down. The aircraft was clean, it was going quickly, and that's all there is to it. He battled a long time over that, but in the end they put an air brake on it, which actually wasn't anywhere near as good as the Swift's air brake, but at least it did slow it down on induced drag, was what I was talking about earlier, not induced G, of course. They did slow it down, and that was therefore useful. For the rest of the things, its manoeuvrability wasn't all that good, wasn't anywhere near as bad as the Swift's, and its tail was in a much better position. When it did run out of manoeuvrability, it wasn't really at an operational stage. They developed a very clever device with a little Y-arm, which was operated by the position of the elevator, and when it was operated, it motored a VI tail around to relieve the stick force and improve the manoeuvrability. This didn't cause any trouble and did in fact produce a fairly workable idea. And once they'd got this in, and mind you, this was on towards the Mark 6, the early marks of the Hunter were better than the Swift. They weren't anything really to write home about. And they also had engine difficulties, because two of the early Marks had Sapphires and two had Rolls-Royce Avons. And the Avon engine ones were always having engine surging problems, rather worse than the Armstrong Siddeley engine ones. And in fact, it was held, I don't know quite how accurate this is, that the Armstrong Siddeley compressor ultimately got really taken over by Rolls-Royce, and that their later engines were developed on that particular basis. But the Hunter went on, and apart from really serious troubles with engine surging during gun firing, which the Swift also had, but the Hunter really had it very badly.
Smoke in the intakes.
Yes, that's right. And that was cured, and they went ahead and, as you know, became certainly in the Mark 6 and the overseas variants of the Mark 6 and the Mark 9, etc., and various 50 series for naval use and Air Force use and other Air Force uses, became really a genuinely memorable aeroplane. Not quite as legendary as the Spitfire, but getting on that way. A very good, as a second generation fighter, an excellent one. Well, at the end, as you've just reminded me, at the end of a long and hard four-year tour in A Squadron at Boscombe, the normal tour length was 3 years, I had the privilege and pleasure of doing the preview handling on the P1A prototype of the Lightning. And if there ever has been a good and joyful introduction to an aeroplane, that was it. We had a great deal of difficulty with the Swift, some difficulty with the Hunter, and here we had an aeroplane where the P1 prototype went through the system absolutely like a charm. Nothing whatever went wrong with it. We did a full preview with myself and one of my Swift colleagues, Flight Lieutenant Ray Kinder. We went through it without a single hiccup of any kind whatever. And of course, from the supersonic point of view, instead of having to battle in a 30-degree dive or whatever to get the aeroplane supersonic, bearing in mind, of course, second-generation aircraft weren't designed to go supersonic, but it would, the second flight I did, it went supersonic in a slight climb at just over 30,000 feet. Nothing happened. The Mark Meeker just flickered and moved on to about 1.05 and steadily upwards. Its supersonic handling was absolutely superb. You couldn't really avoid casting off great bangs in any kind of maneuver exercise you were doing. In those days, of course, there was no caveat that you shouldn't do so. And one cast off some huge ones, including causing, quite accidentally, severe damage to the spire of Salisbury Cathedral, or so the verger said. But that was the way it went. And in actual fact, the Lightning did produce very concentrated bangs. And again, on a second occasion, unwittingly, I did cause structural damage to one of the top-level walls and windows of air traffic control at Boscombe Down. That was all there was to it. We didn't really... We were just trying to get the test done. That was all there was to it. But it was absolutely first class. And the Lightning... I didn't fly Lightnings after that particular time, as a matter of fact. And only two or three months after that, I'd in the interim been over to fly the American aircraft we were talking about earlier. I left Boscombe Down and went to operational requirements as a staff officer. But that was a really splendid memory for the end of what I call a working test flying career, because my subsequent career was in research flying when I was group captain, commanding officer experimental flying at Farnborough. And that's a different kind of game done at a different kind of level, albeit extremely interesting.
What sort of flying did you do there? Which aircraft were involved?
Well, as far as that's concerned, if you turn it off for a minute, I'll have a little look, because I made...
Okay.
Well, the RAE, again, I've been terribly lucky in my career, because to get a group captain's job as a qualified test pilot of COEF RAE in those days, which was from March 65 to early 68, you had a huge piece of responsibility which you were qualified to deal with, and very few other people above you were. To start off with, you had five research airfields to run: Farnborough, Bedford, Llanbedr, Aberporth and West Frew, all of which were active aviating, so that was good from the word go. And of course you had research flying. Test flying, as at Boscombe, you get an aircraft designed for service use and you test it to see whether it's satisfactory for service use. Research flying, you're involved in a research idea which is being tried out on aeroplanes to see whether it works, whether it can be developed for further use or for further research. It's a different attitude. And the aeroplanes one flew there, I think the two main interesting aspects of it were the blind landing experimental unit at Bedford, where whatever British European Airways may have said at the time, all the development worthy of the name on that system was done at BLEU over a very long time, including active fog flying. Great difficulty there, of course, because although it may be thought that this is a foggy nation, in actual fact you don't really get certifiable fog except on a very few days of the year, and that actually was a holdback element in some of those trials. But that was done, it was done in comets, in Vulcans, and also in Varsities. There was an arrangement of aircraft which were specially fitted to research standards to do the work. One of the things you've got to do for a full blind landing system is that you have to have a quadruplex system, four completely different and separate systems, so that there's little chance of their going wrong. One can't give BLEU complete development credit for that, because various other organisations have since been involved in it, but certainly they produced it in a goable form down to standard three landings and so on and so forth before. But nowadays, of course, most of the 747s that that you fly in all do automatic landings as a matter of routine. In fact, it must be very difficult for the pilots and the co-pilots to get their continuation training in. Hence, of course, the value of simulators, which in actual fact was proved in the Lightning, because the Lightning, pretty hairy aeroplane from the performance point of view when it went into service, had absolutely no difficulty in getting it into service, because for the first time in RAF history, an aircraft had a simulator, a full flying simulator, in use before the service first started flying the aeroplane. Generally speaking, in previous generations of aeroplanes, they hadn't even got the trainer variant in service when the original one started, and that did prove an enormous service load. And in fact, the use of simulators for that particular purpose has been well proved now, but it's worthwhile repeating. So there we were at BLEU, and that was fascinating, particularly with trying to develop a takeoff director in a Vulcan, because an auto land system makes you land. Two things then. There was no takeoff director to allow you to take off in fog at that particular time, although there is one now. The other really difficult thing is, of course, when you land on autoland with your great beast doing, 140, 150 knots, something of that sort, down the runway in thick fog, you're absolutely okay when you touch down. What do you do after that? Because the system, you can keep straight, but the system of braking and controlling yourself to the end of the runway, that we thought we got right even in those days. But then when you get to the end of the runway, there you are, with your great beast all stopped, filled with passengers, no booze allowed, one thing and the other. How do you get back to the disembarkation point to get them off the aircraft? You can't taxi in thick fog.
And not even with a follow me truck?
Not just about with a follow me truck, I suppose, but in really thick fog you can't. I believe they've now got airport radars to the extent where they can be used and probably are used. We're going back a good few years in my recollections on that, but certainly when you first got autoland in service, that was one of the difficulties: auto taxi and also direction for takeoff. That was fascinating. The other thing that was fascinating was head-up displays. Well, for fighter pilots originally, very, very important, all started there, and by the time I got there, they had a special research Mark 12 Hunter, which had head-up display equipment in it, and it went from research stage to research stage, and of course that very shortly afterwards went into the service and provided a long-felt want, quite honestly. Very, very useful head-up displays. That was interesting. And perhaps the final point of interest there that was developed at that time was what's now rather ludicrously called fly-by-wire, which is, effectively speaking, fibre optic signalling instead of through electric and electronic sources, instead of having it done by cables. And that was, well, we had there the Avro 707C, the side-by-side bomb, which I'd originally flown at Boscombe just for experience on two or three occasions. It was used there at RE as a research aircraft and did an enormous amount of valuable use there, with one pilot on one side with fly-by-wire equipment and, incidentally, a side-stick controller of various kinds, research on both types going on at the same time, and the other pilot on the other side with conventional controls. It wasn't a very big aircraft. You have never seen the bugger's muddle that the cockpit turned out to be. And there we were.
Yeah. So that really completes your flying career, does it?
It certainly, yes. Where are we? It certainly completed. It completed my active flying career. I went from there back into MOD. I was a group captain by then, of course. I went back into MOD, as it then was. No, it wasn't, I'm sorry. Yes, it was.
Still?
No, it was Air Ministry in my first tour in OR. It was MOD in my second. Where I stumbled over DOD was, of course, I was a DD and then a director of Air Projects. I was still a group captain director. If you ever find any young men accelerating through the Air Force and about to get to that level, never, never advise them if they are offered a really good plum job to be a director, but to be a group captain director, of which in those days there were five or six, and there are now still, I believe, three. Because as a group captain, you have to stuff your fingers into the gear wheels, which are being driven by people much more powerful than you are, and generally tell them that they've done something wrong. But nevertheless, it was a useful job. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been rationalised. But I didn't fly very much there, just the odd continuation thing. And after that, my wife became seriously ill and lost the use of a lung, and I had to go somewhere where she could live. And the Air Force then sent me on the attaché circuit, where I ultimately went to Tehran and Afghanistan, where she could live, and after that, even to Moscow, where she could live. I wasn't a very diplomatic chap earlier on in my career, but it's surprising how much you can learn. However, whatever we did diplomatically, I didn't fly.